Welcome to Ron and Nick's Best Friend Podcast, where we talk about finding the friend who helps us live in freedom, truth, and love.
That's the truth.
All right, now we are recording.
Welcome to Ron and Nick's Best Friend Podcast.
Surrounded by
a podcast that you cannot live without.
Will my heart feel?
And the theme
will I dance with
of transparency.
Or at all, will you be still?
We started this podcast about 2-3 minutes ago, and we had to stop because we got phone calls and we got texts. And man, it was really funny with the way we started off. I don't think we can do it again, but I'm just
that saying, was my best attempt at it.
That, yeah.
I'm not trying again.
Welcome, everybody. This is, you know what I realized?
What?
And it's going to be on the thing because, you know, I'm interviewing today, ladies and gentlemen, I am interviewing Ron, okay? And we'll talk about that for a second. But here's the theme of it. You know, a lot of times and when I'll start talking and you always correct me, I'll go, hey, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be.
I do.
Okay.
Because I think it's funny.
Well, you know why I say that.
No.
Oh, it's because that's what I did. I mean, when I was on stage.
Oh.
Hey, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be doing.
So it's muscle memory.
It's muscle memory, and it's kind of in theme of what we're going to talk about, because we're going to talk about
pretty cool
depression,
ooh,
and how that muscle memory of a instant of my life is 35 years later. I'm still saying good evening, and I can't say good morning because it's always good evening. Now it's stuck in my head. So for those of you that think I'm crazy and I say, you know, I don't know what morning or night is, it's just a little bit of muscle memory of saying, hey, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome tonight to the Coquina Club in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Is that a real place?
Yeah.
Coquina?
The Coquina Club at Landmark Resort Hotel, which is not there anymore. I look it up sometimes when I try to go back in my life and it's called something else.
Okay.
But it was the Coquina Club. So we're going to interview you. We're doing kind of a lot of interviews lately.
People like interviews. I like interviews. I think it's fascinating to hear people's story. I hope more people will come on and be willing to tell their story and just let you. I said this a couple of weeks ago, and I keep saying it. I find it fascinating that you can do what you do, because it's a great study in unique self and identity to watch you do what you do, creator, connector. And it's fun. I've done it for years. And now to do it on purpose and catch it on, you know, record it is fun.
Yeah.
Because I always am fascinated. Like, no one could talk to people the way that, yeah, I could not do it. I cannot do it. You're just really good at it.
You have a different personality. You do other things.
Yeah. Well, I have a different identity. It's not just personality. It's like I don't know. Maybe I'm not interested enough to ask all the questions that you ask, because I'm just looking for the thing to go, oh, there's where I need to disrupt you.
Right.
So that's kind of distracts from getting other biographical things. And
before we start, can you just kind of talk about your book again? We did an interview last week on Ron on this on this new book that he has, The Little Book About Forgiveness. The Little Book About Forgiveness. And listen, ladies and gentlemen, if you have you not heard that podcast, I don't know what number it is, but it's called The Little Red Book. Oh, and The Little Book About Forgiveness.
The Little Book of Forgiveness.
Of Forgiveness.
R. Kenward Jones, by the way.
It is, you have to hear. I think that's one of the best we've ever done, okay? And we're a couple hundred into our
234. Episode 234.
Talk about real quick, and then we're going to get into the subject we're going to talk about. Talk about your book real quick again.
The Little Book of Forgiveness, R. Kenward Jones, A Path to Freedom, came out last week, and a lot of people have already picked it up. I got a lot of good feedback. What it is just a very practical explanation of what forgiveness is not, then what it is, and then how to forgive, how to forgive and how to be forgiven. And it was so weird. I was talking to a dude yesterday, and he literally looked right at me. He said, I know I need to forgive. I just don't know how.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, okay, well, Holy Spirit, just tee that one up. You know, there it is. And I want, you said it a couple times last week, so let's be clear about this. We're not trying to sell books. That's not what we're interested in. What we're interested in is freedom.
Mm.
And if you go back and listen to last week's podcast and apply what we say, you don't need to buy the book. I think the book is just a way to pack, you know, put it together in a way that's like communicable, like here, like you can hand it off to somebody that you don't have time to maybe explain it. It's very, very practical. It's short. It's a little book, less than 90 pages. Yeah. And even Nick read it, most of it.
Yeah. No, I haven't read the book version of it, but I'm going to buy. In fact, I'm going to buy many, 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 many of them because exactly what you just said, when I come across someone that's, I feel that there's unforgiveness or they mention it to me, not that I can't speak into their lives about it. That's for sure. It's not like I hand you a book and say, go for it. But, you know, the truth of the matter is this, maybe I'll learn how to speak to people a little bit more about how to, get them to forgive at the same time, giving them the book. I just thought about that. So it's actually a tool that I'll use.
By the way, I should mention that if you out there are someone who is interested in doing that, something in bulk, let us know. We can get the books to you, for a discount, a significant discount.
You think that would be good? Just hit me you know, a lot of people have small groups that they meet at homes. Would that be
it'd be a fantastic study to do with a home group.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody that you meet.
So you would pause after one chapter and just talk about it?
Sure. Yeah, I think it would generate a lot of discussion. Everybody out there has forgiveness issues, so I know it would be good to just be a good discussion starter.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. I might do that or volunteer that to my small group. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to talk about depression. You wanted me to interview you on depression, so let me preface it with this. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. And I know you're going to say it, but I'm going to say it first because I have a caveat to it. So Ron suffered through 13 years of treatment-resistant depression. Now, you got to know this. I knew him through those 13 years of treatment-resistant depression. I say that because you got to know I've seen the impact that it's had in his life or had in his life. And so I was up close and personal. What do you call a guy that or the person that is with someone with, maybe it's an alcoholic or depressed. You're a codependent.
You're talking about a sponsor?
No, when you're suffering along with them and you're a
I don't know what you're angling towards, codependency, but
that's not codependency.
I say you were just a friend that was suffering alongside. You were a companion. Is that what the word you're looking for? A companion in suffering.
Well, I'm suffering with you. Okay.
Yeah.
You're with the. I mean, your wife suffered more than I would suffer, but I was in the realm of, you know, when we're having conversations and I can hear it. And you know, here's the thing, guys. I would talk to you on several occasions, and I had no influence. Okay. You just kind of wait and listen. That's what you do. You wait, you listen, you're there, and it's like, okay, I'm here when you want to talk, and I love you, and you're encouraging, but you feel helpless a little bit, or at least I felt helpless when I was talking to you. Before I ask you the first question, which I really don't even know what the first question is going to be, but here's another thought I had. Okay, so I'm sure I've been depressed, but nothing like you have. When we talk about depression, is it something that you believe, like if you talk about divorce, okay, you've never been divorced. I've been divorced. I can personally tell you, I think you can emphasize, what's the word? You can understand the feelings.
You have empathy.
Yeah. You have empathy in the things I'm saying, but you've never really felt
right
what I have gone through in divorce and the feelings and the emotions and all that, but you have empathy in it.
Yep.
Do you think, so when we talk about the people that have never been depressed, how can they understand, what words can you tell them to have empathy of if they have a loved one or a friend that is in depression? What can you tell them the feeling it's like. I've been depressed before, but nothing to the degree that you have been.
That's a really good question, hard question.
Yeah, I understand.
This is the word that goes along with depression, this kind of depression, is hopelessness. And
explain that. You wake up.
You wake up and there is no possibility that you're going to be better, that it's going to be better. It's the sorrow that settles in, and it becomes your normal weather pattern. I mean, if you got up every single day and it was overcast, then you would at some point believe that the sun may not exist. I mean, that's a weird metaphor maybe, but if every single day you got up year after, you know, day after day, month after month, year after year, and there was never any sunshine, you might forget that there was a sun, and that you might start believing that this dimness, this darkness is the way that the world is. And emotionally speaking, it's like that. It's like there's no joy, there's no...
Do you remember how it used to be?
Yeah, that's part of the pain of the present is mourning the loss of what was. You know, you can think back on something that gave you pleasure,
right?
Something you enjoyed, and it just turns to ashes in your mouth. It's like you can't even. You look at it, and all you get out of it is sorrow that you can't ever have it again. You will never have it again. It is gone, irrevocably gone, and you will not feel that way again. So it adds to the present sorrow is what happens. The regret of the loss over the past pours into the present. That's part of it.
Now, you told before I knew what we were going to do, we were just talking on the side here. We do that for about 30, 40 minutes, catch up for the week. We don't talk that much during the week. And you said something that was interesting. I didn't really realize it. But you said that, and Ron's old Navy career did a little bit of intel, okay? So he's a researcher. He's into the finding out things and whatever. He's that kind of guy. You told me... You spent hours and hours a day researching depression and treatment. And tell them what you told me, that there was like no, how the story ends.
Yeah, I would sit at my desk for hours on end and type in treatment-resistant depression, because that at a certain point, I went from, the diagnosis was, and the diagnosis is kind of worthless, man. I, like, oh yeah, you're depressed. Thanks. You know, it's like, okay, now I have an official label for it. I went from major depressive disorder, MDD, to treatment-resistant depression, which is a certain number of interventions. Usually the way that they diagnose it is treatment is... certain classes and strengths of psychotropic medicines. And as you've treated that over, I think it's 3 or 4 different courses of that over a certain period of time without any movement in mood, they call that treatment-resistant depression. And so I would sit and Google that. I would find a way. I would type in, I recovered from treatment-resistant depression. And I would read.
You get excited.
I typed it in.
Oh, you typed it. Okay, got it.
And then I would read what came back.
Okay.
And then go through it. It was a lot of you can imagine, it was a lot of pharmaceutical, you know, sponsored ads would come up or sponsored articles. There would be forums of people talking about treatments. There would be, articles here and there, but the thing that I never found an article ever by somebody who recovered from treatment resistant depression and could tell how it happened, and then were still writing about it later and telling you that they had gotten out of it and had maintained a lifestyle out of that depressive state. There was just nothing out there. And then I would go back and type it in again. I would type it, you know, okay, maybe I didn't write it explicitly enough. How can I rephrase it to try to get, you know, recover from treatment-resistant depression and living outside of depression? You know, I'd find another way to try to write it. excuse me. And nothing, I never found ever. Now, maybe there's other people, you know, I think Google is pretty extensive out there, you know, to go get something like this. There was never anything. There was never a story. And that amazed me. And it also terrified me. And I can tell you why, because I was pretty convinced that if someone had ever felt as bad as I had felt, for as long as I had felt it, that if they'd managed to get out, they would not shut up about it. That they would talk about it, that if people knew about it, they would send other people to talk to them about it, and that person, whoever it was who made it out, would have so many people wanting to talk to them that they just couldn't hide it. I was sure about that. You get what I'm saying? Like it would be like the equivalent of emotional becoming the person who figured out how to cure cancer. If you're like, oh, I figured it out. You're not, and you actually can prove it, and you can say, look, here I am. I here it is. I had this, and now I don't, and this is how it happened. That if you could tell somebody that, the world would beat a pathway to your doorstep. They would just like, you wouldn't hide, you couldn't hide. And I was convinced that anybody who did that would be able to tell people about it, and no one would leave them alone. You would constantly be talking about it. And so not finding something like that terrified me, scared me even worse. Because now I'm like, well, if you have treatment-resistant depression, you must not ever recover, because no one recovers, because there's no stories of recovery. I don't see one. And it also occurred to me that if you actually did recover and you never came back to say, I recovered and thank you and this is how I did, you would be the most wicked person in the world. That somebody who felt that bad and then felt better and wasn't kind enough to tell everybody else how, that you're a wicked, wicked person. And that you know, I just couldn't imagine someone being that wicked. It would be like the same, okay, go back to the thing. It would be the same wickedness as you solve the thing about cancer, you cured your own cancer, but you don't give a shit about anybody else. That you're not ever going to tell anybody. That's a wicked person right there. That was a lot. I feel some kind of way about this.
No, well, you went through it. Wow. Let me ask you this. Medication does work for some, don't you think? You mentioned treatment-resistant depression. Do you believe that medicine does help people?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it does. I believe medication does help some people. Probably about 30% of people get really significant help from mood disorders from psychotropic medicine. Probably around 30%. There's a lot of good, you know, whatever you call that, actual research that shows that the numbers around that, which is not the way that it's presented. Like, you know, I'm pretty. Honestly, I get triggered by the ads that come on that are like, there's one for Rexulti, which was one of the meds that I took. That these people hold up these little paddles that have a sad face on it or a happy face on it, and they hold it up in front of their face while they're doing it, and it's like, when that comes on, I get angry. I get like, I feel like angry, because I remember, and I think I remember my nurse practitioner, whoever, a prescriber, talking to me about Rexulti.
How great it was.
How much, you know, hope they had for it. It was an asymmetrical kind of thing that you added on to an antidepressant. And she said, yeah, we call it T-Rex. There was some other T starting, a T antidepressant that you added to Rexulti, and it was like, oh, I call it T-Rex. And I'm like, look, man, I don't want to start saying really bad words on the podcast very often, but that was bullshit. And it just makes me so mad every time I see it, because I know how the... Okay, there you go. What happened every time? False hope. I am hopeless. I'm living hopelessly. I'm living in the dark where there is no sun. And you tell me, hey, look, there's a way that you could see the sun again. There's a way to get the clouds to part. Here it is. It's this and this pill. Put these pills together, and it'll change things. And it didn't help. And your question is, does it work? Yeah, about 30% of people get some help. I think about 30% of people get moderate help where they notice a difference, but it really hasn't moved the dial that much. And then there's a full third of people that get zero help out of psychotropic meds. So, and even that middle third, so the one third that it works, you know, I don't know how well it works, because once you've been that sad, like a little improvement, you might report as a huge improvement.
Right. Oh.
You know, a little bit of light when you live in the dark looks very bright. So I don't really know.
Goodness gracious.
And look, it's wicked. Here's what's wicked about it. People are making tons and tons of money off of this stuff. Just incredible amounts of money. And so there's a vested interest in saying that it works and getting people to say that it works and getting testimonials and things, which was another reason why I was fascinated by it. Okay, no one's going to say that they found a way out of treatment-resistant depression. There's a lot of money to be made. Isn't there?
Sure.
I mean, if I could say this works and treatment-resistant depression has to yield.
Listen, you'll grab for anything.
I mean, yeah, I did. I did, actually. I
did you do
hyperbaric chamber? Yeah. I thought about it one time. I did. I went to a place that did like super duper vitamin B, D, C injections. I did that. I forgot about that. I did that, and the hyperbaric chamber was gonna be.
You did the diets.
I did. Yeah, I did a complete carnivore diet for a long period of time. I did the opposite. I did both. I did went complete vegetarian, went complete carnivore. Yeah,
I knew you did a lot. So we're doing all right. So the reason we're doing this, and we believe the spirit has led us, is that there's a lot of people. You know, for those that never faced depression, keep this podcast. If you ever want to share it with someone who's feeling depressed, if you're depressed, I think you're going to learn a lot from this, and it's another experience that you can take in and maybe use. You got to know this. So Ron is not in depression anymore, but we're not going to get into how that happened yet. Okay, we're not holding it behind our back. We're just kind of giving you the what was happening for 13 years. Okay, and I don't even know half the stuff you did. All I know is sometimes we go out to dinner and go, let me just have the meat. I go, what is, you know?
Yeah, you made me lamb that time, yeah. And I carried it around with me for Christmas.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, I carried it on my Christmas trip so I could eat it instead of ruining people's Christmas dinner.
So, here's another.
We should probably break this up into parts.
Really?
Yeah, because there's all the treatment parts. Like that, I want people to understand what that was about.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I'm saying like we don't have to do it all right now.
No, but we can go on and then we can split it and then put an intro to it, the second part.
Yeah. Well, the
let's see where this goes.
There's the psychotropic medicine part, which is where I think almost everybody starts. Like I actually had somebody tell me this week, hey, I went to my doctor and he said this would help with. You know, and fill in the blanks. And that is exactly what you're going to get out of mainstream Western medicine. If you go to the doctor.
Well, let's start right there. You go to the doctor like your primary care doctor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, go to your PCP and you say, I'm really anxious or I'm really sad. They are going to break out their prescription pad and start writing.
Your primary care doctor is going to give you a prescription.
Yep, they're going to write you a prescription.
Of all the medicines out there, he or she is going to pick something.
Yep.
Sorry, you can cough.
Yep, sorry.
We're sick. Yeah, we're still
don't have a cough switch.
All right. So go ahead. We actually do. I just don't know how to use it. But go ahead.
We've got a really fancy board.
We have a very fancy board in the studio.
We've never figured it out yet.
So he or she's going to pick out a medicine of all the medicines out there.
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Anti-anxiety, antidepressant, asymmetrical. There's different, like Wellbutrin is kind of like an all-purpose one that gets prescribed for a lot of stuff, weight loss, getting off of addictions, things like that. And they'll pick it, whatever they think. And look, I'm not saying these.
We're not being critical. No. But you're just talking your experience.
Well, I am being critical. But,
why?
But, well, because I think that's their go-to. That's their start. And the psychotropic medicines were never developed to be used outside of the context of finding out what's underneath. Like, what's under? Why are you sad?
Oh, my
God. Why are you anxious? They were always supposed to be used in conjunction with therapy of some sort, like talking or some other asymmetrical therapy that would go, okay, let's get at the reason. Like, here's the thing that they'll tell you. Well, you're chemically imbalanced. You're just chemically imbalanced, and that's why you're bipolar, or that's why you're depressed, or that's why you're anxious. Therefore, take this, and then they give you whatever they give you, something that enhances serotonin or norepinephrine or you know any of the neurotransmitters that are in your brain.
I know we're getting deep into it, but what do you mean it was never intended? I've never even heard that.
Well, they were developed to be used in conjunction with therapy. The idea was, from the beginning, it was kind of like this. As far as I can tell by all the study that I've done, is that It was much more supposed to be like, okay, you got a headache, so you take an aspirin. Now your headache goes away,
right?
But you get another headache. You go, oh, okay. Well, why are you getting headaches? While we're working on why you're getting headaches, you take the aspirin so that you can cope with your head hurting so bad, and it knocks the pain down. But you don't just say, hey, you get headaches, so you're going to take Excedrin for the rest of your life. You see. We're gonna, psychologically speaking, we're not gonna just say, well, you got chemical imbalance, so we're just gonna give you this, and now you'll be chemically balanced, and you don't have to worry about it the rest of your life. Just take this the rest of your life. You don't see that? You don't understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So no, now
I didn't know it was not intended without asymmetrical. You meant
there was the people that were developing these were psychologists and psychiatrists. You know, they were people who are concerned with the state of the mind, and so it's where all these things like cross over: neurology, psychology, Western medicine. We're all trying to do a good thing, because depression is terrible. I mean, you meet somebody that's in hopelessness, you're just saying, like, how hard is it to be around someone who's living in hopelessness? Okay, well, let's do something about it. And so they started to develop these things. And I believe the idea was good at first. Like, okay, you're so depressed you can't get out of bed. Well, let's give something to you that will address that physically, or so that you can have some functionality. And now in your functionality, let's work on how you got there. Okay?
Right, okay.
Let's not just say, well, you have a chemical imbalance, which is implying that you have a physical defect that you can make up for, like having rickets. I mean, give you some vitamin C, and so you get over your rickets. But that's not the way that they're treated now. You go to your PCP and you say you're anxious. He's going to say, "Well, here, take this."
Okay.
And
then the cycle starts.
Yeah, and then the cycle starts. how did you get chemically imbalanced? Is a good question, right?
Yeah.
Like, what happened? So when you got depressed because your wife left you and your life was going to hell, that made sense. It did depress you, and it chemically affected you. Your serotonin levels were probably down. Well, there's ways to address that, and then one of them would be working out. One of them would be going for a walk. One of them would be like doing things that are good for you that bring those endorphins back into your system, and you address and get some of the stress out just by sweating it out. Also, you could have taken an antidepressant, and maybe that would have elevated your mood. But if your mood stays down and doesn't come back, now you've got a problem, and you need to address it some way. And I understand that. But the real way to address it, was the real way to address it by just pumping chemicals into your body? Or was it like, let's talk about what you think now, how you think, and why your mind is stuck on hopelessness and loss. And like that. Now let's talk about that. Like, what do you really think about that? Because it's your mind is very powerful. Everybody knows that. Your brain is very, very powerful. And if you were just today to start focusing on hopelessness and hopeless thoughts, I'm pretty sure that you can affect yourself chemically in a way that you can drag your chemistry down into what you would call a chemical imbalance. Do it long enough, and it stays down, and you start to lose hope.
So I'm going to ask you this question here. And listen, I didn't think we were going to go this direction, but this is just good information here. Would you suggest to someone, if they're depressed and they're taking some kind of medicine for that, that they should incorporate some kind of psychological or counseling while they're doing that?
Yeah.
Would that help?
Yeah. Look, I would say to anybody who's taking that's using psychotropic medicines right now, and the question would be, would you rather not? Would you rather not? Meaning, if all things being equal, if you could have a well emotionally regulated life, would you rather not have to take a pill every day?
And the answer, of course, is yes.
I've never met anybody that didn't say yes.
Okay. You know,
even when the time that the psychotropic medicines did work for me, which they did for a certain period of time.
Right.
I would have said, boy, I would rather not have to take this. It's weird. It's right. Weird putting something in your body every day that makes you, that you know is affecting mood, which is affecting identity.
Yeah.
Like, who am I?
Right.
So the answer is, yeah, I would much rather not take that. So is that possible? No.
Is what possible?
Is it possible to have an emotionally regulated life and not have to take those psychotropic medicines?
Yeah, right.
The people who are taking it out there, there's a mixed bag. Like, the first question, yes, I would rather not. The second question is going to be a mixed bag of things because people don't believe it because they've been told things. Like, you're chemically imbalanced. You will always be chemically imbalanced. You will have to take this, and they will fight you. They will get actually very angry if you suggest that they don't have to take that medicine anymore for any reason. They'll get very upset because it's terrifying to think of going back to something.
Oh man, I know people like that.
Yeah, so sad and out of control.
I know people like that.
Yeah, they'll fight you.
And I've suggested it, and
you don't understand.
Yeah, and I shut up.
And you don't.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't.
Good point.
You know, and I'm not saying that I do, and I'm certainly not suggesting. Okay, well, just stop taking all your psychotropic meds. That's not what the message is. The message is it possible to have a fully emotionally regulated life and not be on psychotropic meds? And the answer is absolutely yes. It is possible. And I'm not, you can argue with me all you want, but I have lived it, and therefore I'm not going to take no for an answer. I'm not going to go, no, you can't. I am a walking, living proof.
Right.
That is possible.
And that's why I feel comfortable about this conversation, because as you were talking, I'm sitting there going, whoa, wait a second. It's definitely not me, but listen, don't be talking here like we're the experts. But then I immediately said, wait a second, you've actually gone through it. So let's keep going on this subject here. Whether it works or not work for somebody, you've gone through it. So you get permission to tell your story and what you've learned and what you've went through.
Sure, it's proof of concept. I mean, it doesn't mean that I am the rule. I might be the exception. As I've said, like I'm looking for stories. I'm looking for stories.
When you're on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of people who have recovered, and I don't find any. Now, is that just an SEO problem? Like there's not, I have a hard time believing that. I really do. I don't know.
Hard time believing what? That you're the only story?
Yeah, I have a tendency to believe that if my story was, I don't understand why it hasn't taken root. Like, I don't know that if people just don't believe that I'm telling the truth, or if it is an SEO problem. Like, how do you get the word out there? There is a way that you don't have to live in the dark anymore. And it's accessible and it's not expensive.
I don't want to go to there yet. I don't want to go to your story. All right. So I'm gonna. All right. Let's go to this one. Now, people may not know that you are a counselor. That's what you do for a living. Okay. Every single day. I remember many. I don't want to go there because it might give the solution for you away. But okay, this is what Ron does every day. When you have someone come to you as a client and they come to you, I'm not telling you to give the full story away, and they come to you and you know that they're depressed and they tell you that they're depressed, what's your first thought in your heart, in your mind?
That they're depressed?
Yeah. They're, hey, listen, Ron, I'm anxious. I can't get up during the day. I'm sad constantly. What is immediately, are you getting excited or are you listening? Are you finding out what their past is? Are you finding out what their present is, their job? Where are you going with that when you hear that? Or are you just there?
First, it says kind of a loaded question. I mean, the first time I meet somebody who is describing that, I want to move towards them and break the isolation and say, I really understand.
Ah.
And I really see. And I really hear you, and you're really important, and that you're loved. That's what I want them to know.
Why?
Because the isolation of living like this is just devastating. It's like no one understands. You can't really tell anybody. I mean, you can. I lived it. Like trying to tell somebody, you know, you can look in somebody's eyes and know that they don't know. I knew that you didn't know. And I knew that Tina didn't know. And I knew that the most important people in my life did not know.
So you feel that when you say that, there's a sense of comfort that yeah. They go, you understand.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that there are several people who just come to see me that aren't, look, I'm not saying that how I got better works instantaneously for anybody. It didn't work instantaneously for me. And I think there are a lot of people who just need to sit with somebody who understands and it gives them hope. And to be seen and heard. And actually, as I think back through the 13 years, you, even though you didn't get it, and even though there were like all the people around me, nobody around me got this, understood this to this level. But I had a group of people that let me say where I was and loved me and even learned to leave me alone. There was a people that I said, there were safe people and there were not safe people. The safe people were the people like you and Tina and others who I could say, look, I am hopeless. I'm hopeless. There is no such thing as a son. Well, you know better than that. There's a son, right? But when I say there's no such thing as a son, you didn't feel the need to tell me that there was one, explain how I was going to one day see it, you know, give me 17 things. And then those are not the safe people. The safe people were the ones who are just like, let me say the stupid, dark things and then just didn't leave.
And why aren't they safe? Because
the non-safe people will always offer you a solution that is not necessarily real. It's always too simple. It's always too like, well, why don't you just, you know, it's just, it's not like that. And you know, it's not like that. Yeah. And even if it is like that, it's not working for you right now. So just shut up.
Right. All right. Makes you feel worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, now I'm a failure because you told me to do this and it makes, yeah, exactly. And it's not working.
Yeah. And then you're sad and more isolated because you find out like there, it's even less hope. And joy, and you're alone, and for someone to just sit, and this is what happened. Though. It got down to the place where I had a safe place on the couch, and I could just sit on the couch, and Tina would sit on the other side of the couch, and I would just sit there, And I had a safe spot. That was my safe spot. There were two safe spots, that and my bed. And I wanted to, like, I would live my life between getting back to those safe spots. And it was really long and hard.
I think let's end it right here, because I think we're going to go to the second part next week on what happens. Because the interesting thing you just said to me was what you say to someone that is suffering from depression. And it really lit up in my head when you said, "Hey, I understand what you're going through. I love you. I hear you. I'm with you. I'm in the moment with you." And here's the most important part that you said, that they know that you know. And I think the next week we're gonna talk about that part.
Thanks for joining us today for this week's episode of Ron and Nick's Best Friend Podcast, where we talk about who?
The best friend who tells us how to live in freedom, truth, and love. For more information about him or the show, you can join us at www.ronandnicksbestfriend.com.
And don't forget to subscribe.
I think it's great. No, there's great stuff there.